Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Maryland Representative Elijah Cummings died this morning. He was 68 and serving his 13th term in Congress, where he was a high-ranking Democrat and chair of the House Oversight and Reform Committee. That made him a key figure in the impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump. We're talking national politics today with political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Welcome back, Ken.
Thank you, Ann. Good morning.
The news of the death of Representative Cummings wasn't exactly a surprise. He's been ill. What do you know about him? What do you remember about him?
Well, I remember a lot of things. I mean, it was not a surprise. You're absolutely right. He was in a motorized wheelchair for a long time. He had longstanding health problems. He had heart valve surgery several years ago, and there were some complications from that as well. But this guy was... He spoke with such a way that people listened, and I think he was able to reach across party lines, even though he's a, let's face it, a very liberal Democrat living in the urban city of Baltimore, that rat-infested, rodent-infested city that Donald Trump dismissed quite sadly. But he spoke with great authority, and he'll be deeply missed. He was a decent guy. He had civility and decency, and he believed in democracy, and he believed in the will of the people to learn the truth. And of course, we all saw him earlier this year when Michael Cohen, President Trump's former fixer, testified before the committee and later went to jail. But he ran a fair committee. And sometimes he would get emotional because he cared so much about not only the Constitution, but his constituency in Baltimore, a tremendous loss for the Congress and for the country.
The president this morning called Cummings irreplaceable. A replacement at this kind of critical juncture?
Well, of course, you cannot appoint a member of Congress when there's a vacancy, unlike the Senate, where you could, appoint someone. Mm-hmm. There will have to be a special election. It's obviously an overwhelmingly Democratic district. The incumbent before Cummings was Kwasi Mfume, who left Congress in 96 to become the head of the NAACP. There will be a special election, but more importantly, there's a tremendous void at the top of the Democratic leadership, given the fact that he was just so widely respected and revered.
How does that work as far as the chairmanship of the House Oversight and Reform Committee?
It would be, as long as the Democrats control Congress with a majority of Congress, and they do, it would be the next ranking member, the next person in line for seniority. Sometimes the members of the Democrat or Republican caucus could decide to elevate somebody up in seniority to the chairmanship. But for the most part, it's the next in line for seniority.
He was an activist. You said he was a forthright liberal. He was born to former sharecroppers, and he worked to integrate Baltimore public facilities as a child. I mean, he was an activist, right?
He was an activist, but again, he was not somebody who yelled or mm-hmm. raised his voice unless he had to. He had this quiet dignity that all you had to do is watch him during the Michael Cohen hearings, mm-hmm. that he showed respect for the other side, one of his closest friends. This is kind of the most bizarre thing I've ever heard, but one of his closest friends on the committee was Mark Meadows, the very conservative Republican from North Carolina. But I think what I think Cummings appreciated was respect for the process and respect for decency. And I think if you treated Cummings that way, he would certainly treat you that way. But there were some members of Congress who just loved to yell, and on both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans. That was never Elijah Cummings. He was always, that when he spoke and when he did raise his voice, it was for a very important cause.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Ken Rudin, we'll post a link to Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Talking national politics, we've just been remembering Democratic Representative Elijah Cummings, who represented Baltimore since 1996. He died this morning. He was 68. He was chair of the House Oversight and Reform Committee, and that made him a key figure in the impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump, which we will talk about as well later on this hour. If you have a question or comment for Ken Rudin, give us a call, 614-292-8255. 8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ken, before we got too far along, I wanted to talk about the debate on Tuesday, famously in Westerville, Ohio, a suburb of Columbus, where we're at right now. Anyone jump out at you as a winner, or are we just mostly going by the polls these days?
Well, you know, the polls can fluctuate, and of course, we've known from the beginning that by his standing as former vice president, the loyal vice president to Barack Obama, 36 years in the Senate, everybody knows who he is. Joe Biden would enter this race as the front runner, and he was. But we've seen a continuing, not so much a decline of his standing, but others moving up in the polls. And we knew from the early polls that Joe Biden must have been the front runner because everybody was attacking him. Right. Remember, in the first debate, Kamala Harris would attack him for his ties with Southern segregationists and his views on school busing in the 1970s. Julian Castro, in the third debate, mocked his, well, I don't know if it was senility he was getting at, but the fact that, don't you remember what you just said 2 minutes ago? Obviously, it was a small dig at his age, mm-hmm. Joe Biden's age, which is 76 years old. He'll be 77 next month. On Tuesday night, all the attacks seem to go on Elizabeth Warren, which seems to be a recognition that she has become because of moving up in the polls, mm-hmm. which she has. And nobody seems to lay a glove on her. She's very almost flawless in the debate. She may not answer all the questions as thoroughly as some people would like, but she's moved up. So when Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, mm-hmm. and Pete Buttigieg, they focus their ire on Elizabeth Warren. The fact that, well, you know, how much will this cost taxpayers? How much, you know, we pay in taxes for your Medicare for All plan? And if you listen to what Elizabeth Warren said, which I thought was pretty flawless, she not once said the word taxes. Mm-hmm. So there is legitimacy to the argument that she may not be as forthcoming and what her plan would cost as some candidates would like. But it seems like since she was the focus of so many attacks, she must be the leader in the poll. I hate the word front runner because I'd like to leave that to the voters. I mean, we still have less than four months to go, mm-hmm. before Iowa and New Hampshire begin. And when the voters start to make their case in February and March and beyond, then maybe we could say front runners. But at least in the polls, she seems to be moving up rapidly.
As far as the health care issue goes, Senator Bernie Sanders was more than willing to fill in the blanks for the other debaters on the stage. Let's hear.
But let me take this moment, if I might, to thank so many people from all over this country, including many of my colleagues up here, for their love, for their prayers, for their well wishes. And I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. And I'm so happy to be back here with you this evening.
I thought that was another cut about health care.
Well, I knew something. I'm glad you played that cut because even though, yes, I was also expecting a cut on health care. But if you listen to one of the things I was looking for the most is Bernie Sanders. He 2 weeks ago, he suffered a heart attack. And look, people suffer heart attacks, but not many presidential candidates are 78 years old. When a 78-year-old person suffers a heart attack, one is concerned and mm-hmm. rightfully so. And so I was looking at Bernie Sanders from the moment the debate started, but he was very energetic. You wouldn't know for a second that he had any kind of health issue at all. Mm-hmm. He was very passionate about his health care for all plan. When Joe Biden was talking about Joe Biden could get things done, Bernie Sanders said, look, Joe, I love you a lot, but you got things done with the Iraqi war. You got things done with an unpopular trade deal in NAFTA. He was very sharp on his feet and literally on his feet mm-hmm. for 3 hours.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the kind of the concerns you had going into that debate. He was very good, I thought.
I was exhausted laying on my couch watching it. It was impressive.
You know, it's hard reaching for popcorn. It hurts your arm.
Take the words right out of my mouth. But, you know, he was wise probably to lay low after the stents were in put in and that kind of a thing. He did have a heart attack, and he was out of commission for you know,
2 weeks. Yeah,
2 weeks. So he looked refreshed.
Well, he has not released all his medical records. He promised to do that before Iowa, but he hasn't done that yet. Mm-hmm. He has refused to allow anybody to interview his doctors. So there is some concern that, well, maybe we don't know everything. But again, judging from what we saw on the stage on Tuesday night, he looked quite more energetic than some of the other candidates. And 12 candidates on stage, a record number, 12 candidates.
I have to say, though, you know, obviously everyone didn't get equal time. That no one's they haven't been giving out equal time for a long time now. So that's not even, to me, an issue. But it felt like it went rather swimmingly.
Well, 3 hours is 3 hours. That's very true.
It was exhausting.
But something I thought so, too. Now, you will notice, fairly or unfairly, that candidates seem to get the most – the candidates who get the most airtime are the ones who are leading the polls. Mm-hmm. Tom Steyer, for example, the new candidate, the billionaire who has led the impeachment fight for at least 2 years now, got the fewest amount of minutes. Elizabeth Warren, because she got so many questions directed at her, got the most. But if you think of the top five, if you think of Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg, or at least the top four, they got a lot. I thought that Amy Klobuchar was perhaps offering her most impressive debate performance. And maybe I'm wondering if the fact that Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar were so energetic and forceful, I wonder if the feeling is in some way that if Joe Biden, who is the champion of moderation as opposed to Warren and Sanders, if Joe Biden shows any weakness, maybe Klobuchar and Buttigieg feel that they could be the moderate alternative to Warren and or Sanders. And I saw very aggressive and respectful performances for the two of them on Tuesday.
Right. It was an interesting stage, too. It was diverse in many different ways.
Well,
historically,
it was. I mean,
diverse.
Well, historic. I mean, when you have, you know, you had Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, two African Americans. You had several women. You had Klobuchar and Warren and Harris and Tulsi Gabbard, and which is, you know, I mean, everything is historic in the 2020 Democratic field. And we have the Pete Buttigieg is 37, and that's very young, and Tulsi Gabbard is 38. And then you have Bernie Sanders, who's 78, Joe Biden, who's 76, and Elizabeth Warren, who's 70. Now, Elizabeth Warren would be if she's elected, she would be the oldest person ever elected to a first term as president. But at the same time, she would be the youngest woman ever elected as president. So that's one another way of looking at it.
If I could be as vigorous as she is now, I'd be happy.
Well, yeah, especially when you're on the couch watching that debate,
exactly.
Right?
We will continue our conversation.
You know, by the way, that image will stay with me during this break right now.
It was caramel corn. We will continue our conversation with Ken Rudin, a political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. By the way, we'll have a link to the podcast on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Ken, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@WOSU.org. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. On Wednesday, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina criticized President Trump over his decision last week to pull U.S. troops from the Syrian side of the border with Turkey. Graham has been one of Trump's staunchest supporters in the Senate, but that didn't stop the president from retaliating later Wednesday.
Lindsey Graham would like to stay in the Middle East for the next 1,000 years with thousands of soldiers and fighting other people's wars. I want to get out of the Middle East. I think Lindsey should focus right now on judiciary like the Democrats.
We're talking national politics today with Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. He joins us every month. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ken Rudin, what about the relationship between Trump and Graham? Has it reached a breaking point again?
Well, the reason I don't know why I'm laughing, because it seemed like it's so interesting when you listen to Lindsey Graham in 2016 mm-hmm. and 2015, he called Trump, a liar. And the words that Lindsey Graham used about Donald Trump were just awful. And then, of course, he became a sycophant in the course of a year or two, which is remarkable. But it reminds me, here's the thing. These guys and gals will be jurors in an impeachment trial if it ever reaches the Senate. When I think of Richard Nixon at the end, when the end of Richard Nixon came when the Republican Party started to turn against him. For the longest time, even after the Saturday Night Massacre, everybody, including Republicans, said impeachment's out of the question. Towards the end, Republicans changed. The fact that President Trump will go out of his way to insult Republicans. I mean, he's insulted Kevin McCarthy, the Republican minority leader in the House. He went after Lindsey Graham. He said, as you heard on the tape, that, well, he wants to be there for 1,000 years, or he should be investigating Democrats and President Obama rather than, talking about this stuff. He is alienating his own party, even though among Republican voters, his numbers are very, very high. But when you have a vote in the House, 354-60, when two-thirds of your own Republicans vote against your Syria policy or whatever that policy is, mm-hmm. I mean, he just said, look, I told Erdogan I just had enough of it. It's none of our business. Let's get out of there. And nobody runs foreign policy that way. And so Lindsey Graham, who, despite his admiration for President Trump, is a foreign policy hawk, the late John McCain was. And when there's clearly an indication that American foreign policy interests are in jeopardy, he speaks out. And a lot of people, a lot of Republicans have spoken out this week, yeah. That's for sure.
Well, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is telling his members to prepare for an impeachment trial now. He's saying that they'll probably be working 6 days a week, probably sometime around Thanksgiving. I mean, it's coming.
Yeah, no, it is definitely coming. And the only difference, of course, between the Nixon almost impeachment and the Clinton impeachment is that both Nixon and Clinton were already in their second term. The voters already had their say. This is coming as the 2020 presidential election is just getting started, or at least about to get started, with voters having their say. So it's going to be an unbelievable, and I don't mean that in a good way. Usually I say, like, if the Yankees win the World Series, that's unbelievable,
but not good way.
In a not good way, because you're going to have impeachment and the election at the same time. And my goodness.
Yeah, it's busy. Now, some people are worried about the optics of that. I mean, there's always the worry about impeachment and when you're the party pursuing it and what that means down the road. But again, like you said, this is unprecedented during an election cycle to be going through this.
Right. And we saw, look, some Republicans did pay the price in 1998 and again in 2000 for their zeal to impeach President Clinton back then. And even, in fact, Republicans lost seats in the 1998 midterms, even though the 6th year of the Clinton presidency, because people felt they went too far with Clinton and Clinton remained a very popular president. That's not the case with Donald Trump. A majority of the American people feel, first of all, an overwhelming majority feel that the impeachment inquiry is correct. And a majority has now come up saying that that he should be impeached and perhaps removed from office now. But the Trump base doesn't feel that way. The Trump base is still convinced that it's illegitimate, it's unconstitutional, and it's basically trying to overturn the 2016 election. That's the Rudy Giuliani,
right,
Donald Trump argument. But a lot of Republicans do say that you don't have to be, you know, off the walls to say that this should be decided by the voters. So the country, whether even if it's a majority that wants impeachment, the country will be desperately split, perhaps down the middle on impeachment, the wisdom of impeachment. Democrats, I think that's why I think that Nancy Pelosi has been doing it right. She has not. She's been very cautious. She made a point of waiting, even though some of the, you know, the more radical members of the Democratic Party, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortezes, who wanted Donald Trump impeached in 1990, you know, she's saying, well, let's wait and see. Let's hold off until we get more Americans. Now, of course, she would like more Republicans standing up for impeachment. And to this date, not one incumbent member of the House or Senate on the Republican side has called out for impeachment. That's not what Nancy Pelosi would like. But she's very dogged. She has very strong. I mean, losing Elijah Cummings is a great blow, but he was going to be one of the chairmen looking into this. But basically, it's being led by Adam Schiff, the Democratic chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, who is very thorough, very smart, and she's going to try to make an airtight case. And I suspect that the vote for impeachment will come sooner than later. And, you know, it's interesting, even if, look, nobody in the world thinks that two-thirds of the Senate will vote, and especially a Republican Senate, will vote to remove President Trump from office. But you have vulnerable Senate Republicans up for re-election in 2020, like Susan Collins in Maine, like Tom Tillis in North Carolina, like Cory Gardner in Colorado, like Martha McSally in Arizona, who has a tough vote to cast because they like to portray themselves as somewhat independent. But if you betray Republican voters, they'll make you pay for it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We're talking national politics today. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513. Now, how do the Democrats come out with the White House stonewalling strategy regarding the impeachment inquiry?
I'm not sure I understand.
How do they
the
respond to that? I mean, what can be brought to bear?
Well, that's what's fascinating about this whole thing. The fact is that they're refusing. The White House is refusing to cooperate with the inquiry. They're ignoring subpoenas. They're ignoring requests for documents. They're refusing to testify. Mike Pompeo and Rudy Giuliani, everybody's saying no because Donald Trump says we will not acquiesce in an illegal and unconstitutional process. But what's interesting is that in the last several days, more and more career people in the State Department and elsewhere, not partisans, but people who've been there a long time, have testified. Yeah. Former aides to Pompeo have testified.
The top aide to Pompeo.
The top aide,
just
exactly.
Resigned. I mean, has he testified yet? Or
I think either he has or he plans to. And this is something that, you know, you wonder about. You remember this guy named nobody ever heard of, Alexander Butterfield, who, I'm sorry, everything is Nixon impeachment with me, but Alexander Butterfield, who just happened to say, oh, by the way, you know, there are recordings in the White House. Boom. I mean, that opened up everything. And so I think that rather than rail and beat the drums and say that the Trump administration is stonewalling and obstructing of justice, which they may be doing, they are still getting testimony. The people who are investigating for the impeachment are getting testimony, and the process goes on.
It's kind of astounding. You know, you're talking about a State Department where they're kind of walking away, and it was a State Department that was already in disarray. It was one that was chewed up and spit out already before Mike Pompeo came on the scene at all. I mean, I just wonder who is doing the work of the American diplomatic corps out there right now.
Well, you know, so many people, like the people, especially regarding the Ukraine situation,
yeah.
People have been fired, people have been dismissed, people have been shunted aside by the administration because they don't see eye to eye. So look, you know something, the combination, I don't really want to give up on Syria just yet because...
No, I don't either.
No, and the reason I say that is because ostensibly the reason there's an impeachment inquiry is what went on with Ukraine and the fact that the president has gone to foreign leaders of Ukraine and perhaps China and other countries as well to get dirt on his Democratic opponents, which, as Elijah Cummings said, is far worse than Watergate. But the fact is that when you have the president of the United States who says basically that, you know, we don't care, you know, this is nothing to do with us in Syria, and Russia suddenly is now the power in Western Syria. Well, I mean, you know, not that we should be the policemen of the world, but you don't just have an agreement with Erdogan saying, okay, we'll pull out tomorrow, and boom, the next day, Turkey goes in and starts massacring Kurdish forces, and then you have the president of the United States saying, well, the Kurds are no angels, and the Democrats obviously like the Kurds because there are some communists with them. That's remarkable. And
well, there's consternation as well in the military ranks, right?
Oh, absolutely. I've seen a lot of the reports, not always verified because it's anonymous sources, but from reporters who say the people, the military in the field are just flabbergasted and stunned about this kind of decision. And to send Pompeo and Mike Pence and others to Turkey to try to reason with Erdogan after we already gave him the okay to do what he's doing, I mean, it's more than just closing the barn after the horses are out. It's just astonishing.
I think,
how many times have I said the word astonishing?
So unbelievable,
in the last 3 years?
Astonishing. Yeah. Yeah. Another astonishing visual. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi yesterday said Trump called her a third grade politician at a White House meeting where she criticized his withdrawal of the U.S. troops from northern Syria. And then after she walked out of the meeting with House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer of Maryland, she accused Trump of having a meltdown, and then he tweeted a photo of what he called Nervous Nancy Unhinged Meltdown. I mean...
Oh, yeah, and he tweeted that she's sick. She's a sick person, and we should pray for her. It's reminding... You notice she didn't rise to the bait. Yes, no. she did say that that the president suffered a serious meltdown, but apparently what the president said or reacted is just almost unhinged, and you just wonder how long can Republicans keep defending this kind of behavior? And I know every time I go on your show, I'm so aware of this, that I sound like, well, I'm part of the media, so I must hate Trump. It's not that. It's not because he appoints conservative judges. It's not because he cuts taxes.
It's all of
his
right.
Well, he ran on those issues, mm-hmm. and he's fulfilling these conservative promises. And he wanted a change from Obama and Hillary Clinton, and he's done that. It's the integrity, the decency, the honesty, the foreign policy that makes sense. And when you do something on a whim because you know you're right and the military advisors are wrong, something is wrong here.
Joe in London, you're on the air. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, I just had a thought. Is impeachment without removal from office just basically censure? And has Congress ever censured a president?
No, we haven't. That's a good question. We have censured fellow members of Congress. I think there's admonishment, and then there's censure, and then there's impeachment in that line.
Okay.
And I remember that some Democrats during the Clinton thing said, forget about impeachment, let's just censure the president for his behavior, and Republicans wanted to go for higher. What an impeachment does is that you're brought up on charges, and if you're found guilty by the House, then it goes to the Senate for a trial where 2/3 is needed to remove the president from office. Of course, you know, two presidents have been impeached, Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton. Richard Nixon would have been impeached, but he resigned before that happened. But no president, and I think only 8 federal judges have been impeached and removed from office in history. So it's a censure would be one step below that. But I don't think Democrats are talking about that anymore.
What is censure anyways? I mean, what does it do?
It puts, well, it, I mean, it's a stain on your record.
Yeah.
There's no, you don't lose pension. You don't lose a pension either way. But basically it just puts the House or the Senate on record saying that we disapprove so severely of this president's actions that he is censured for his conduct or behavior or policy. But that's all it is. And the Senate does not have to get involved.
Joe, thanks a lot for that call. Let's see. Dave and Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, Dave.
Hi there. I had a question for your guest. 63 million people voted for Donald Trump. And in my opinion, Donald Trump's the worst thing that happened to our country since the Vietnam War, even worse than 9/11. And I talked to people. I haven't spoken to one person that voted for Donald Trump that isn't ready to vote for Donald Trump again. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't know what he can do that's going to convince his base that they need to vote for someone else. The only thing, I think the only hope is that we have, we bring more people out and that we don't dilute our vote. I mean, I blame all these people that wrote in John McCain or wrote in John Kasich or wrote in Bernie Sanders for Trump being in office now.
So there's a couple things in there, Dave, and thanks for that call. Ken Rudin, he talks about the Trump base is kind of mythical. I mean, not mythical, legendary at this point in their intransigence, right? Dave makes a good point, but
Dave makes a very good point. As a matter of fact, Donald Trump has that famous quote from 2015 that I can walk in the middle of Fifth Avenue in New York and shoot someone and my supporters will not leave me. And that's been basically, I mean, that's a real quote. Mm-hmm. And there's some truth to that because whatever in the 3 years of the president, has it only been 3 years? Mm-hmm. In the 3 years of President Trump being in office, his numbers have not gone up or down. They're basically 43% support and 51% whatever opposed, but his base has stayed the same. And so he may not, he may not increase his support share of the vote. He may not win over undecided voters at all, but his base is staying with him. And what his campaign is doing, I mean, we're focusing on the 20 or so Democrats running for president, but what Donald Trump is doing, he has millions and millions of dollars, and he's pouring them into Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania and Florida already, making, with ads and Facebook ads and things like that. And those are the four states that basically elected him in 2016, even though Hillary Clinton got more votes. He got those electoral votes that put him over the top. He knows where he's weakest. He's not going to spend money in California, which he's not going to win. He's not going to spend money in New York, which he's not going to win. He's going to work on those four states, plus the Ohios and the Iowas and the mm-hmm. North Carolinas that are very close and marginal. And that's how you win elections. Sadly, for better or worse, you go where the electoral votes are most in dispute or most contested, and you spend the money there. And Trump and the campaign, and matter of fact, Hillary Clinton way outspent Donald Trump in 2016. That's not going to happen in 2020.
Right.
And the Democrats have to realize that they're up against a very, very strong adversary, no question.
Is there any clues for us in the fact that the head of the Republican National Committee and, the likes of rats, the names are escaping me, but they're moving around in groups, meeting with GOP women. They met with about 125 GOP women in the upscale suburb of Powell on Tuesday night here in Columbia, in the central Ohio, talking to them about Donald Trump and why he's so great.
Well, look, there's no question that Trump is hurting with women. The fact is a majority of white women voted for Trump in 2016, which you think, wow, really, with Hillary Clinton running, a majority of white women voted for Trump? They did. But since then, given the fact that we saw the day after the inauguration, this million women's march, the women's march that showed their disdain for Donald Trump, he has a lot of work to do. And that's why the Republicans are very smart to be looking after women. The fact is, there are only, I think, 13 Republican House members, female House members, after the 2018 midterm elections. Right. So the Republicans do have a problem with female voters, and they're working hard to see if they can increase their support. One more thing about what Dave said, which I liked. He talked about, well, people wrote in John Kasich and John McCain. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who were Bernie Sanders people, yep, who felt that Hillary Clinton and the DNC had their finger on the scales, rigged the election, and many voted for Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate. And in some states, the number of votes that Jill Stein had was more than the difference between Trump and Clinton. So you can blame. Look, there's so many things to blame or to attribute to Donald Trump winning. James Comey coming out at the end talking about investigations. Mm-hmm. But Bernie Sanders, I mean, Sanders supporters will not like to hear this, but for the most part, let's not even blame Bernie Sanders, but there were Sanders supporters, many of whom either sat out the 2016 election or voted for Jill Stein or other third-party candidates. And I think Democrats realize they cannot repeat that mistake if they're going to win in 2020.
We have one more segment left with Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking national politics today with political journalist Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. You can find a link to his website at WOSU.org/All Sides. If you have a question or comment about national politics, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. There was an issue that's coming up now. It's been talked about ad nauseum. I just wanted to chat with you about it a little bit. And that's the idea of electability among the Democratic presidential candidates. No one thought Trump was electable at a certain point in 2016. And some say that this issue of electability is sort of just a justification to nominate another moderate white male for the job. What do you think, Ken Rudin?
That's a great. So let me just interrupt for one quick thing, because it's something we talked about earlier.
Okay.
The new chair, or at least the acting chair of the House Oversight Committee, is going to be Carolyn Maloney. Hmm. She is a Democrat from the east side of Manhattan in New York. She is the next in seniority on the committee, so she'll probably be the next chair of House Oversight.
To replace the deceased Elijah Cummings, right?
Elijah Cummings. Okay, right. That's a very important question, and that basically was the argument for Joe Biden's candidacy for the longest time, that, mm-hmm, well, maybe I made some mistakes over the years, maybe I supported an Iraqi war that I shouldn't have, but I can beat Donald Trump. Well, there are more and more polls out there that shows that Elizabeth Warren could beat Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders could beat Donald Trump. So I don't think that argument for a moderate goes by the wayside. But the fact is that the Democrats are still split about being pragmatic and thinking that, let me go for a safe candidate who can win. And you're absolutely right. The day of the election in 2016, I didn't think Donald Trump could win. So, mm-hmm, we should not be in the prediction business, but Democrats should decide what's more important to them, being ideologically pure or able to win. And I think that's the argument that people like Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg and Kamala Harris and others are saying, that, look, I don't have to be 100% in your corner regarding ideological issues, but if you feel I could be on the stage with Donald Trump and beat him in the debates and beating the election, that's more important. But again, that's something that the voters are going to have to decide come starting February 3rd in Iowa.
Let's see. Mark in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I think the Democrats just don't understand that it could be Donald Duck in the position of the Republican nominee, and we would vote for him because we just don't want any socialism. We don't want to lose our group health plan. We don't want the WOTUS rule. That's the Waters of the United States rule that Obama tried to implement, where the bureaucrats can come into your backyard and tell you how to contour your yard for runoff control. And I know that for a fact. I have a copy of that law on my computer. So it doesn't really make a difference who's running on the Republican side. We're going to vote to stop socialism. That's the whole agenda right there.
Ken Rudin.
Well, look, I mean, that is not only a Republican argument. Democrats are saying the same thing. It's not so much socialism. And, of course, the Republicans and President Trump love to call the Democrats socialists. And Bernie Sanders says, I am a socialist. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says, I am a socialist. Elizabeth Warren says, I am a capitalist. But their plan about taking, 149, 150 million people off their private insurance and part, make it part of a government-run Medicare for All plan, that is controversial. And the question that not only Republicans are asking, but Democrats are asking as well, is middle America, is the rest of America willing to do that? And I think one of the reasons you're seeing so much blowback against Elizabeth Warren, as we saw Tuesday night in the debate, is that there are Democrats who are concerned that this kind of philosophy, this kind of policy may be too radical for the American electorate. And that's what the Democrats are going to have to decide. It's disappointing to say that everybody, every Republican will vote for Donald Duck against any Democrat, because I think there are things that should be taken into consideration, like decency and honesty and integrity and civility. But that's another thing altogether. The fact is that the argument about unpopular positions or controversial positions, such as, a Medicare for All and eliminating private insurance, that is a very debatable and controversial issue within the Democratic Party.
Mark, thanks for that call. Let's see. Jennifer in Bowling Green, you're on the air. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on what Ken mentioned, that Democrats haven't decided yet if they want a progressive nominee or a less progressive nominee like Biden. But if you add up Elizabeth Warren's support and Bernie's support, it just blows Biden right out of the water. So I just wanted to mention that, and I'll hang up now.
Thank you. Yeah, right. That's an interesting point.
That is absolutely true, but it's yet to be proven that, let's just say, if Bernie Sanders faded, if all his supporters would go to Elizabeth Warren, they might, but you don't know that. And I think we've seen in the past that polls in October of the year before the election may not be the same as February or March, when the voters have their say. Remember, Rick Perry was a front runner one time. Rudy Giuliani was the Republican front runner in October of the year before he ran. Hillary Clinton was definitely going to be the nominee in 2008 until this skinny guy from Chicago, Barack Obama, came along. So I understand that right now the polls, and I agree, I think Joe Biden actually is fading. I don't know who's going to be the nominee. I don't think it's going to be Joe Biden, because even for all his argument that he can win and his kind of politics will win, he has not impressed me in the debates. He seems to be stumbling over his words, stumbling over thoughts, and for him to say that I could beat him like a drum, I think fewer and fewer Democrats feel that way. But again, Jennifer is exactly right. If you combine Warren plus Bernie, it's much more than what Biden has. That's true.
The Democrats have to light a fire in the belly of the voters.
Yes.
They've got to turn them out.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that everybody has made a decision yet. I mean, again,
right.
I don't know how many people are watching the debates. I don't know. I mean, there are, obviously people in Iowa and New Hampshire are engaged, and Nevada and South Carolina, because the candidates are going there constantly. But I think the rest of the country is still waiting and seeing. They want to see if Joe Biden has the stuff to do it. They want to see what Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have to say. And what about the Pete Buttigieg? He's suddenly rising a little bit.
I know how to spell his name and pronounce it too.
That's right. That's right. So it's a good thing George Duke Majorn of California isn't running, because I'd have trouble with that spelling. But I mean, that's the point. The point is, we do have a long way to go, and I don't think we're close to anything yet. But it's interesting that with these debates, more and more candidates are finding everything, these debates, as life and death situations, even before voters have their say. We're seeing people like Kirsten Gillibrand and others like that, and people just dropping out of the race because they're not in the debates. Usually they drop out after the voters say no in Iowa, New Hampshire, in the primary. So it's accelerating much quicker, and it's very possible by the end of the year we have a debate next November. Only 8 candidates have qualified so far. Mm-hmm.
Are you there? Ken?
You're not hearing me?
I hear you now. Yep.
Okay, sorry. I mean, so we have another debate in November where only 8 candidates have qualified.
We lost you again. Ken? All right, well then let's get to the call. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We are mystified, but we've lost Ken Rudin. If you want to give us a call and save my bacon right now, I've got about 3 more minutes left. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What do you think? Do Democrats have to light a fire? Do they have to turn out the vote, number one, and what's it going to take to do that? And who do you think could do it? What do you think about the debates? I think it was 8 have qualified so far for the next debate in November. It would be a break if we didn't have 12 people on the stage. What did you think of this past debate? 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have had a technical issue.
No, we haven't.
Ken Rudin. You're right back. Okay.
No, I was getting your caramel popcorn.
Okay, get my caramel popcorn. All right. Shoot. All right. I wanted to ask you something about fundraising. There's been a lot of stuff about fundraising that Biden's not keeping up with that. He said, hey, he started later than everybody else. Of course, he's going to be, he didn't start with $10 million in the bank from a Senate run or something like that. How much should people be paying attention to that right now?
Well, it's not a campaign issue, but it's a lame excuse to say I just started late because everybody knows Joe Biden. And basically, Joe Biden has been having these big donor fundraisers where he's still in third place behind Bernie. Bernie Sanders raised $25 million last quarter, which for all you'll say, well, Bernie's old and he's not healthy and he has socialist views. The fact is he's raising a ton of money, which means he has a lot of support in the Democratic Party, as does Elizabeth Warren, who's raised a lot of money as well. So I don't know if it's a sign. Well, first of all, you need to raise a lot of money to get in these debates.
Right.
But I would not dismiss the fact that Biden's numbers, fundraising numbers, have gone down.
All right. So the month ahead, we have more hearings in the House regarding the impeachment inquiry. We maybe have coming up maybe a month from now, you and I talking about what the Senate's going to do with that, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we may have a vote before that. We have another debate on November 20th. Mm-hmm. As you know, my birthday is November 13th. There's so much to look forward to. I can't believe it.
I just want to take a moment. When we lost connection with you, Ken,
I asked
the listeners to call in, to save my bacon. And the phones lit up like a Christmas tree. So I just want to tell everybody out there, thank you.
Oh, and thank you for the call. The calls, as always on your show, they're great. And We hear from all sides, and that's absolutely true.
That's the goal. Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Thanks as always, Ken. See you next month.
And thank you.
That's it right now. Thank you again for calling in and trying to help me out there. And thanks as always for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.